Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1.
And welcome to the programme. Today, groundbreaking research reveals interesting findings about pigeons and how they may be using their sense of smell to find their way home. Less than 1 year after the installation of two sea bins in Howth Harbour, we ask marine scientist Rowan Byrne, how are they doing? And it's autumn, the rutting season for deer. Terry Flanagan reports.
Just listen to that. I'm in a small wood in the Phoenix Park close to the American Ambassador's residence, and I'm watching and listening to the fallow deer as they go about the business of mating.
Good man, Terry. He takes all the risky jobs. That's why he's the reporter, you know. Good evening, welcome to the programme. And let me begin by saying thank you to the Leggett family in County Cork, who sent us the most wonderful handmade card using all the colours in the rainbow. It says, happy 25th anniversary. And then you open it up and inside it says, to Derek and all the Mooney Goes Wild team, thank you for all the fascinating facts, funny anecdotes, wise observations and wonderful entertainment through the years from all the Leggett family in Cork. Thank you, guys. Thanks to everyone who sent a text message, an email or a card congratulating us on reaching our 25th Silver Jubilee in May. We're still here. We are delighted to be here. Now to tonight's programme, and I'm joined by contributors from locations throughout the country. So let's start by going to Kilcool in County Wicklow, to Niall Hatch. Niall, how are you?
Hi, Derek. How are you doing? I'm here in my kitchen in a nice, comfortable chair, looking forward to having a nice chat with you and Richard and all the contributors to the programme today.
Very good. Richard, you're in Malahide.
I am indeed, Derek. Yes, how are you?
Very good, Richard. Now, I want to start the programme today with news of awards. So cue the fanfare. Now, let me read from the citation. It says, Rowan's passion and drive for sustainability is infectious. His sustainability leadership shines through everything he does. Whether it's meeting young professionals in his role as sustainability leader in Mott MacDonald's Environment Division or tackling marine plastic waste in his local community. He has the ability to bring people together and engage them in developing practical solutions. Rowan also has the ability to link detailed technical work to the big picture. Rowan is based in Cambridge and has been a fellow of the Royal Society of Biology since 2014. He has worked in the NGO sector as an academic with many published papers to his name and in the private sector for 25 years. Rowan is an advocate for the reduction of plastics in waterways and oceans and has single-handedly driven the Mott MacDonald Marine Plastic Initiative. Who am I talking about? I'm talking about a regular contributor to this programme, Rowan Byrne, originally from Howth. Rowan now lives in Cambridge, which is where he joins us from now. Rowan, you're the man of the moment.
Well, Derek, I've been blessed. Over the last year, we've been working hard, obviously, on our sustainability and plastics and lots of other work. And I got nominated for an award as sustainability leader by IEMA, one of the UK and Irish largest institutes for environmental management. And they gave me an award last month for the work that we're doing and being as sustainable as we can to leave a better legacy for the future generations.
Well, you deserve it. And I noticed when I read through the citation, they mentioned the fact, and we discussed it with you on the radio programme, that you had installed two sea bins in Howth Harbour. How has that worked out? And explain to the listeners again what sea bins are.
Derek, that's been a phenomenal piece of equipment. It's nearly COVID-proof. Over the last year, it's been now 13 months since we installed two sea bins, one with Mott MacDonald in the local community and the other one with Panda Recycling there in Coolock. And this is absolutely true figures. I cannot believe this myself. Over the last year, we have removed 16-ton bags of plastics from the harbour waters and the coastal waters of Howth. So much so, and it bringing up a legacy of old plastics. A good example would be, you're probably too young to remember Premier Dairies in Coolock, Derek.
No, I'm not. I'm 53. I remember.
Well, I couldn't believe it when I found it. We found a small plastic bottle that had Premier Dairies Coolock on it when you used to have the tinfoil lid on it. Mm-hmm. I think the last time plastic bottles were used of that ilk were late 70s. We found it in the sea bin. We found it. We found a legacy of old plastics. We found plastic Yoplait plastic yogurts celebrating the 1986 Olympics in a yogurt carton. And it just goes to show the longevity of plastic in the marine environment. But it's definitely shown us one thing amongst many others, and that is its impact on biodiversity in the coastal environment. This will be a first reported via yourself and your team, Derek, is that while we're going through the sea bin, we get seaweed in there, mm-hmm. different types of bladderwrack and different types of fucoids. And I'm noticing in the seaweed, there's a lot of small, fragmented, teeny-weeny small pieces of plastic. And that is definitely having an impact on local biodiversity because it's impacting with the seaweeds. The main thing I'm seeing here is that our problem is getting much bigger while the fragments of plastic get smaller. But the sea bin is a piece of tech, basically, as at the top you were mentioning, where basically we have it in the sea and it filters the water, thousands and thousands of litre every hour, every day. As I said, it's COVID-proof, it's still ticking over, and it just filters the water, oxygenates it, removes oil and hydrocarbons and slicks from the surface, but also filters out any floating debris or plastic. Great piece of kit, and we have two in Howth, one in Howth Yacht Club as a control in a marina, and the other one in Howth Harbour with Harry and his team in the working harbour. And we do have plans to look at putting more in there, and we're talking with Harry and his team and the guys in Howth to look at do more. Given
sounds to me like
impact.
There should be one in every harbour around the country.
Well, I'll be honest, Erica, it wouldn't do any harm.
Are they expensive?
They can vary between 3,000 to 5,000 euro per bin. Now, you might say that's a few bob for a bin. It is, but at the end of the day, it's not a price you can put on the environment. It's a very small price you can put on the environment for the benefit that it's done. I'd like to reiterate, it's removed 16 single bags, ton bags, by volume of plastic over the last 12 months.
Now, how do you say it's COVID-proof? What does that mean, it's COVID-proof? I mean, it's filtering the water and it's taking all the debris out of the water and presumably it's gathering in some little collection point, which is part of the bin design. But somebody has to come and take that out. Pick it up.
You do.
And dispose of it.
You're absolutely right. When I say COVID-proof, I mean when everything else shuts down, the sea bin doesn't. It keeps basically doing its job of filtering the water, collecting floating plastics, collecting debris, collecting particulate matters, collecting rope and wire and monofilament. So you just leave it on and then a single individual will come over and empty it. And this is the best thing that Harry and his team in Howth will tell you. It's reduced their frequency of a need to go around the harbour in the boat collecting floating debris that works its way into the air.
Well, we could do them at all the lock gates, I think, along the Grand and Royal Canal. I mean, I know the volunteers and Waterways Ireland do a tremendous job trying to clean up, but they can't keep up with the volume of litter that's been dumped there. And it sounds to me like this could be a solution. Is it big and who sells them? Are you behind this? Are you making money out of this? Or
No, nothing to do with me. As ever, Derek, I'm not the designer, nor do we own it, anything to do with it. I'm a big fan of the tech. If I can find tech that does that helps the environment, I'll give my best to support it. And this is a bespoke piece of tech that was being designed by two surfers in Australia. Long story short, they wanted to go surfing. Their mum and dad told them, clean the pool before you go surfing. And then after you clean the pool, you can go. So what they did was they went down to Home Depot, as they call it over there, or B&Q, or you know, any home base. And they got a bin and a fuel pump and a net. And they put it across the top, put it in the pool, and then came back and they found the pool was clean. And then they said, how can we do more about this? And it's just grown and grown and grown now over the last 5 to 10 years. And as the name suggests, it's a bin that filters water, collects floating debris and plastic.
Rowan, can I just ask you in relation to Howth, where you've taken out obviously 16 ton bags of this plastic material, what has now happened to that plastic? Was much of it able to be recycled, for example?
Yeah, part of it goes back to the Marine Institute. They have along with Harry and his team, they have a fisheries program there where they collect all the plastic. The problem with recycling is obviously it's spoiled plastic and you need different types of polymers in order to recycle it. The types of plastics we're getting are mostly single-use plastic wrapping facilities from sort of single-use products. But we're also getting a number of oil containers that would have high-density polyethylene plastics, polyurethane, even polyvinyl like PVC. And they're the sort of things that can be recycled. recycled? It's an excellent question, Niall, because that's the key to it. This plastic can be monetized. This plastic is worth a few bob. And you'll find that in circumstances like this, once you have enough of it, and once there's a frequency of it, you can actually recycle it. A lot of this plastic, depending on its composite, depending on its material or polymer makeup, in other words, the different types of oil and hydrocarbons and materials that are in it, can be recycled. So I know a new company is actually working further afield, as one example, in fisheries in Nigeria, where they're getting fishermen to go out and fish for plastic bottles. And what they do is they take these plastic balls and then they shred them, they clean them, and they shred them into pellets, into noodles, and they recycle them again. So the next stage of evolution is very much finding a way where technology can support cleansing, for want of a better word, cleaning the plastic and then recycling it. And I know plastic is recycled where it can be, it just depends on the makeup. But the really cool thing is that I mentioned the Premier Dairies milk bottle there at the start of the conversation. I found small barnacles, Semibalanus balanoides, small barnacles you normally find on rocky shores, which filter out all the microorganisms in the water. I found them growing on the plastic bottle. That's complete habitat change. Those creatures should not be found on plastic floating debris. It also shows us another way that plastic flotillas, plastics acts as a transport mechanism in order to transport invasive species. In other words, species you wouldn't find in the Irish coast that might be working their way across the Atlantic. Well, I know we've seen it from debris and ships sinking and things like that from the coast of America working their way across to the south coast. So the thing about the sea bin here, its primary purpose obviously is to collect plastic, get it out of the water, close that loop. That's the name of the game. But it's also providing us information on habitat change, species distribution, invasive species and their movements around the Irish coast from foreign fields. I get too excited, if I'm being honest, when I get into the bin. You just do not know what you're going to find.
I believe that the face masks are getting on your wick at the moment.
Yeah,
as well.
They are, Derek.
I mean, careful with my words there. You can appreciate
it. You're grand. Listen, you're absolutely right. Single-use face masks are designed by polypropylene plastic to do their job and protect us and keep us safe. That's the most important thing. There's no cutting corners on health and safety. It's very important. But disposal of them is extremely important. We're finding a lot of single-use face masks, just ones you'd normally buy, 50p, 50 euro, a euro, whatever it is, and they're working their way into the sea. They're working their way into the coastal harbours, into the wastewater treatment works and into the riverine environments. Now, they will last up to 450 years. Latex gloves will do the same as well. They'll last for a similar amount of time. So what we're
I'm wearing a pair of blue ones as we speak, believe it or not, I actually am wearing latex gloves.
Well, there's nothing wrong with them. Absolutely not. It's just how we dispose of them. That's all I'm saying. So what we're finding is that a large amount of this this health and safety PPE is working its way because it's improperly disposed. So what I think we can do is we can use multiple use masks. We can wash our hands more often. We can still use single use face masks, but they are working their way into the sea. I mean, you have to remember, pre-COVID, we had 13 million tons of plastic entering the sea every year. And that's of all different guises. That's like 34,000 plastic bottles a minute going into the sea. So one of the ways we need to do this is really cut the tap off. Be safe, be protected from COVID. But also remember that plastic alone isn't going to protect us from COVID. It's everything that goes with it. But we just make sure we don't dispose of them improperly, because they will, by normal pathway pollution receptors, in other words, hits the streets, hits the sewers, into the harbour. Make sure when you dispose them, cut the ear ties either side. So that way, as a bare minimum, that way nothing can get entangled in them. As in like wildlife and birds and things like that as well. But please dispose them properly. That's because it's getting to, you know, a pandemic, for want of a better expression.
So just to reiterate, Rowan is saying wear your mask. Yes. Think about how you dispose of it. Talk to you again, Rowan. Keep in touch. That's Rowan Byrne. Now, John Riley, our researcher, has popped in with news of another award.
Indeed. The James Dyson Award is a well-known international design award that celebrates and encourages designers of new problem-solving ideas, Derek, with a particular emphasis on innovation. Over 1,700 young inventors from 27 countries have entered for the award this year, and that has been whittled down to just 20 finalists. Mm-hmm. Ireland's Niamh Damery has made that cut. She designed Econoc. Econoc is a hive made from mycelium.
A beehive.
It's a, yeah, exactly. It's a beehive. It's made from mycelium, which is the vegetative body for fungi that produces mushrooms, of course. And Neve's idea was to create a hive that biomimics or recreates the shape of a tree hollow, the perfect space for bees to move around in a cluster during the winter months. Natural tree hollows, these natural hive habitats, are lesser seen now, Derek. Why is that? Why do we see fewer tree hollows, this natural space for
a beehive? I don't know. You got to tell me.
It is because trees no longer live to that age or maturity where a natural hollowing occurs. And this will be down to deforestation, the cutting down of trees, or climate change, which is blowing older trees over. Thus, the need to recreate this tree hollow space. Mm. So I had a chat with Neve and I started by asking her why mycelium was a suitable material for the hive.
So mycelium is an insulating material, similar to the polystyrene used in polystyrene hives, which are commercialised now. It keeps the bees warm, especially in the Irish weather. It also has added benefits. So Paul Stamets, things that come from mycelium that bees actually use to fight the varroa mite, which carries viruses into a hive. So there's that added benefit that it could actually protect the bees from varroa mite.
The project is about giving black bees a safe place to create a hive like they would in the wild. Why the particular focus on black bees?
The problem is with the deforestation in Ireland and the lack of mature trees that they don't have the wild places for them to nest. So this hive biomimics the hollow of a tree. So like the space that naturally occurs in old trees. So it's literally just a cylindrical shape and they thrive in those areas. They're better at surviving in that kind of space. Not only honeybees, but all animals rely on like their habitats. And because there's a decrease in the number of trees, because there wasn't as many planted or because of global warming and, you know, the mature trees that were their habitat have fallen because of storms or been cut down for developments and things like this. There isn't as many mature trees and they don't get the chance to get to the mature stage where they have a hollow in the tree. Due to this, they have less habitat and every animal, no matter if it's a pollinator or a badger, they all need their habitats to survive just like we do. So this hive, this kind of conservation hive is far more important because it gives them the natural space for them to survive in.
Sounds like a wonderful idea and we'll be interested to see how it develops. Very best of luck, Neve.
Thank you so much and thanks for having me on.
Thank you, John. And Neve, we'll just have to watch this space and see how she does. Great innovation there. Now, October is the month of conkers and the month when the clocks go back. Went back at the weekend. But it's also the month of the rut. Yes, the rutting season is now upon us. And in the life cycle of deer, it's the most important time. It's the mating season with males building up a harem of females. As each becomes receptive, he mates with them. But it's not just as simple as that. Oh no. So last Saturday morning, I headed into studio and Terry headed off to the Phoenix Park to keep an eye on activities. Needless to say, he kept a social distance from the rutting deer.
As you know, Derek, the park is a big place. 1,752 acres, to be precise. And I'm close to the American Embassy, looking out here over the 15 acres. And just to give you a little bit of history about the park, it started life as a deer park over 350 years ago, back in the 1660s or so. And there's been a close association with deer throughout that time. In fact, the American Ambassador's residence just here behind me, it's correctly known as or referred to as Deerfield. And throughout the park's existence, there's been a herd of fallow deer here in the park. So it's no surprise that it's the deer I'm here to see today. Fallow deer are very sociable animals and are often seen in large herds, like here in the park. And for most of the year, the males and the females live separate lives. Most people don't realise that. Males in one part of the park, females in a different part. But when we get to the breeding season, or the rut as it's known, well, the testosterone levels rise and the males go in search of the females and they can become quite loud. You can probably hear them in the background there. They can also become quite aggressive towards other males and fights regularly occur.
I take it you're not too close, Terence. You're keeping your distance.
No. I'm a good 100 metres or so away. The public are encouraged to stay away from them. They are wild animals and at this time of year, the males have only one thing on their minds. And with those magnificent antlers, If you got in between two fighting males, you could easily get seriously injured.
The good and the bad about the fallow deer in the Phoenix Park is they're very accessible, but still, we got to keep that distance.
People should stay at least 100 metres away. And yes, it has become popular recently for some members of the public to feed them by hand. But the park rangers and the Office of Public Works, they advise against this for a number of reasons. Now, the obvious one is safety of the public from those antlers. But you'd be amazed at what some people feed them. I remember a report we did a number of years ago. I don't know whether you remember it, Derek.
Try me.
We did a report on this very subject, and I saw a number of Spanish students feeding them with the ham from their sandwiches.
Oh,
and when I
yes,
asked them why they were doing
at all.
It, their answer was to get a selfie with them. They actually thought that they were doing the deer a favour by feeding them with meat. But what many people don't realise is deer are herbivores. They feed on plant material, mostly grasses. I think 90% of their diet is grass. The remainder is made up of things like seeds and acorns and so on. So their digestive system is not suited to digest meat, and it's actually bad for them. And it's also best that you don't feed them apples or carrots. They may become dependent on these supplementary foods. And it's also taming them. And we must remember that these are wild animals.
Just for the benefit of the listeners, Terry, how do you tell the difference between the male and the female, and what exactly is happening right now?
Well, the males, they're easy to identify. They're the ones with the antlers. And at this time of the year, they dig a little shallow hole or scrape in the ground, and they urinate in it. And they also spray themselves with urine, a kind of aftershave, to attract the females. And guess what? It works. They each have a group of females, and when each female becomes receptive, he mates with her. And this mating process, it takes only a few seconds, so it's easy to miss it.
And dare I ask, have you actually seen it happen?
Yes, you have to be alert, and I am about 100 metres away. But another reason why it's so quick is because each male, or buck as they're called, he has to try and keep watch over all his females. And while he's mating with one of his females, other males are trying to sneak in for a quickie with one of his females. So it's a stressful time for the males trying to impregnate all their own females and stop the intruders. Oh, and also, he'll try and do the business with a female from the next group. So as you can see, Derek, it's a hard life for the males at this time of year.
I'm sure there's many people thinking it's a great life to be a male, particularly at this time of year.
On the surface, it might seem so. Having 20 or 4 females, whew, what more could you ask for? But during the rut, the males don't have time to eat. They lose a huge amount of body weight. They expend a huge amount of energy. They're very vocal. They fight constantly. And those antlers, they can do serious damage. It's not unknown for a deer to lose an eye or even to die in a fight.
When I think of the deer in the Phoenix Park, I think of Tommy Hayden, formerly of UCD, Terry.
About 30 years ago, Tommy Hayden from UCD started studying these deer. And you'd often see Tom and a group of his students up here observing and actually filming the rut. Tom referred to this time of year as the season of sex and violence. You would also see them in June searching for the young fawns to catch and to tag them. They don't manage to get every newborn, but they tag about 100 each June. And they also take vital recordings such as the weight of the animal, the sex of the animal and things like that. In reality, they'd probably never catch these animals again, because they're so fast. And a few of them have GPS as well, so that their movements can be followed. Tom has now retired, and Favelle Nolte, she continued on the work. And in fact, if I'm not mistaken, this is the longest continuous study of one herd in the world.
How are the numbers there, Terry? Are they doing well?
Very good. As Tom Hayden said to me once, any deer that can be pregnant is pregnant. They've no natural predators here, things like wolves. In fact, the greatest problem is cars. And a number of years ago, I remember John McCullen telling me that about one a week was being killed by cars here in the park. And that's one of the reasons why they closed off those side roads. And in fact, it has definitely helped.
Is it true they cull the deer in the park?
Yes, the OPW, they like to maintain the herd at about 600. If numbers are to increase much more than this, then there'll be competition for food, leading to malnutrition, which leads to a build-up of parasites and other pathogens. So a cull is carried out to remove the old and the infirm. It may sound cruel, but in fact, it maintains a healthy herd.
Where else can people see deer in Ireland other than the Phoenix Park?
Well, there's nowhere else in the country where you can get so close to them as you can here in the Phoenix Park. And during the rut, at this time in late October, that's the best time to watch them. But if you can't get to the park, then there are other options. There are a number of fallow deer farms throughout the country, and you might manage to be able to see them from the roads outside. There are also fallow deer in Donerail Park in County Cork, there's one I know of, Pertumna Forest Park in County Galway, and they are the most widespread deer in Ireland. But remember, don't get too close. Don't disturb them. Don't get in between them, and certainly don't feed them. Do like I'm doing here. Enjoy them from a distance.
Yes, as Terry said there, make sure if you're going to go out and have a look at the rut, do it from a very safe distance. Thank you very much indeed, Terry. Now, we were asking at the top of the programme, is lockdown loneliness making us loners? This is a question raised by new research. It is often said that man is a social animal, and so you might think that level 5 social restrictions would be out of step with our natural state, and quarantine would make us want the company of others even more, wouldn't it? However, researchers at University College London have found isolation can lead to a decreased desire for social interaction. So, is lockdown loneliness making us loners? We're joined now from London by Dr. Ilana Driosti from UCL's Department of Cell and Development Biology. Hello, Ilana. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too as well.
Tell me about this research.
So what we do in my lab is that we study a little fish, which are called zebrafish. And we're interested in studying their social behavior. And what we have done is basically we put this fish in isolation. Socially, they are socially isolated. And then we try to understand what happens to them. And this is very timely because as we are all experiencing right now, we are all in a lockdown. So we're all our social contacts are reduced. Mm-hmm. And then basically, what we see is that the fish that have been isolated, they have an increase in their anxiety levels. And I feel like this is exactly what happens right now with pretty much all of us that we have been isolated for such a long time.
Ilana, that's very interesting. Zebra fish. I kept zebra fish in the old days. I used to have them. They're tiny little things, 3 centimetres long at most, I think. Now, how do you test these? How can you get access to these? How can you examine, for instance, their brains?
Yeah, so zebrafish are very, very interesting models because they are transparent when they are young. And so what we can do, we can literally look at each single cell in the brain. And so what we do in my lab, we use larvae up to juvenile fish, which are pretty much 3 weeks old. And we study either what happens in the brain in terms of function, what are the brain areas that are activated, and also what is their behavior. So we basically analyze these two components. And what we have found is exactly that social isolation causes not only changes in their behavior, but also in their functional activity, in their brain areas that are activated.
Well, now, what are the changes that you notice? These are shoal fish, and I remember them. They used to like to keep together, I thought. Isolation would not be their thing. Now, if you put one in isolation, what happens? How does it start misbehaving?
Yeah, exactly. So zebrafish are very social animals and they all swim together, they shoal together, and probably you've seen them in many aquariums. And what we do is that when we put them in isolation, they cannot see any other fish from the very beginning. In the moment when we put them back with other fish, what you see is basically that they freeze and they stare at the other fish. So clearly something is going on. This in zebrafish, it's a sign they have an increase of their anxiety levels.
Well, now there is a minority in the zebrafish world which is solitary. For instance, I believe about 10% of fish like to live on their own. Now, the social ones, when you put them on their own, do they become like these isolated types?
That's a good point. So like in the whole population, like, you know, within humans, there are people that are very social and there are people that are less social, right? So, and this is exactly what is happening to all of us that we're in lockdown. So there are people that they can cope much better with this moments of isolation because they may be more loner people. And there are others that clearly for them is very an unbearable situation. So in fish, it's exactly the same. So what happens is that we have the majority of the fish that are very social, but there is also a proportion of fish that are less social. And then when we put them in isolation, what happens, basically, we push this population to become more antisocial. We haven't tested exactly what happens before and after, in the sense that we haven't checked for the sociality before we put them in isolation and see if what are the fish that become more antisocial. But what we can say is that within the whole population, fish tend to be more antisocial in general.
So both social and antisocial traits seem to have survival value. They're both retained in the population. Now you take your social one, you put it in isolation and it becomes antisocial. Is there some kind of epigenetic effect here? Is this something triggering a gene that was dormant until something happened and now it's a new type of behavior?
Yeah, that's a very, very interesting question. So we haven't answered this yet, but what we are going to do is exactly the following. So we can now sort fish for their sociality. So we can put the fish that are social and grow them and keep them and then breed them. And at the same time, we can take the fish that are antisocial and breed those ones. What we can do, we can look at their offsprings and then study at the genetic level what happens and if there are any major differences within the two populations.
Well, now, when you return a fish that has been isolated for 2 days or so, and you return him to his normal life, does he become normal again, or does he stay solitary from then on?
We haven't tested this for a long time. So what we do currently is we take the fish that have been isolated, we put them with other fish for 15 minutes. And what we see is that at the very beginning, they are freezing, they do barely move, and then slowly they start to approach the other fish and they start to become more and more social. It's exactly what we want to do in the future. So we want to test if there are any effects that are more long-term in terms of like having such a long isolation in the fish.
In relation to the anxiety levels felt by the fish, what are the consequences to them from that? Does it affect, for example, their appetite? Does it shorten their lifespan if they're under this constant stress? Or are there any other consequences that you're noticing?
Those are great questions. So we haven't tested them. So what we know from the population studies in humans is exactly the following. So if you put humans in isolation, or if they have this perception of being isolated, this perception of loneliness, there is a 30% decrease in their lifespan, which is totally unrelated with many other facts from age and or sex. And they also have many other diseases, from cardiovascular diseases and others. So definitely is something that we want to test, and hopefully we're going to know something soon.
I know that a lot of us human beings who found ourselves isolated in the last few months and with less human and social contact have taken great comfort from the companionship of pets, be it dogs or cats or perhaps even pet fish. It does seem to have a real benefit to a lot of people, particularly find themselves in a lonely situation. Do you have any idea if these zebrafish feel any sense of companionship or any reduction in anxiety through exposure to other benign species other than their own?
I actually feel exactly the same. I can sympathize with people that find discomfort in animals, I think. With zebrafish, we haven't tested this, so we still have to explore completely. Yeah, but it's a great idea.
Turning to the human situation, I get conflicting opinions expressed in the media. One opinion is that isolation is bad for us and we become depressed and neurotic and we die younger and everything else. But back into my mind comes a Scottish seaman from the beginning of the 19th century named Alexander Selkirk. Famous case. He was marooned for over 4 years, 4 years, 3 months or something, on a South Pacific island, and was rescued at the end of that time. And the captain who rescued him was amazed at how normal, how balanced, how peaceful and everything that Alexander Selkirk was. So much so that he gave him command of one of his ships, and Selkirk completed a circumnavigation of the world. Now, if isolation is so bad, how could 4.5 years of total isolation not affect this man?
I have 2 points to make. So either this person is clearly a loner, so is a person that really enjoys to be alone. So it belongs to some like a slow percentage of people that they find rewarding the fact to be alone. Or what happened to this person is basically the following. So it doesn't have to be social isolation and physical social isolation. What is more important is how isolation, social isolation is perceived. So even people that are together in the same house with other people, they can feel extremely lonely. So if this person, for instance, was, yes, physically alone, but in reality was not mentally alone, because in his mind, I mean, he had the memory of the people that he loved at home or someone that could give him comfort, then this person was not actually alone. So, and I think this is basically the major difference that we need to keep in mind. So even when we interact with other people, so it's like the real interactions with the few friends or the few people around us that we care, which are the more important for our mental and physical health.
Do we have to reestablish friendship? If you are brought into a situation where you know nobody, say a dinner party, everybody's very nice and polite and you're very in exaggerated politeness mode and you're smiling and everything else, but you can be quite ill at ease underneath and so are they. So you take a while to develop protocols by which you relate to these people, and over time some of them may become your friends. Now you're a zebrafish or you're a person who's away from the herd for a while. These things break down. You have to re-establish them. So is it that he is really neurotic, or just that he has the task of trying to re-establish the connections he had before?
To be friends, you need to spend a certain amount of time together. So that's what studies say. So there is a certain even like threshold of hours to say like, okay, you can start to call this person friend. And in terms of being able to make connections, again, it's a practice procedure, right? So you have to, you know, the first time it doesn't go well, the second time maybe it gets better. So you have to get to learn how to interact with friends, and in fish is the same. So what happens is probably a combination of the two. So if you're in isolation, you kind of like lose this practice to understand how you interact with other fish. So what fish they do, for instance, and like humans, we all synchronize even without knowing some of our behavior. For instance, it is well known that people in an audience, they start to synchronize their posture or even the blinking of the eyes. And in fish it's the same. So when they swim, and they interact with their friends, they start to synchronize their swimming, their motion. So, so what we need to know, basically what we need to study, is to look at these features in order to understand what is happening to those fish.
I found the study of social animals to be really, really fascinating. And I'm a bird specialist myself, mainly. And one of the things that I've always been fascinated by is the way that many bird species go through a sort of cycle of being very sociable and then very antisocial towards each other, which is, you know, I find it really interesting. So in the breeding season, many birds are extremely territorial. There's a pair together, but they won't tolerate anyone else encroaching on their habitat. But then after the breeding season, in the autumn and the winter, they'll flock together in groups of hundreds or even thousands together, you know, more pairs of eyes looking out for danger, more bodies huddled together for warmth, these kind of things. So it does seem to be quite cyclical in many bird species. I know with a lot of other species, you know, we have different stages in life when creatures are sometimes very sociable and then that changes. So elephants, for example, you know that the young males are with the herds, these matriarchal societies. But then very often when they get older, the males, the bulls, are rejected from those societies. They live alone while the matriarchal groups stay together. You have wolf packs, but then there's always lone wolves as well who go out on their own. It seems that there's some interesting parallels with humans there, and also with the zebrafish. Just, that's a very long-winded way, I suppose, of asking you, do you know with the zebrafish if this is something that changes throughout their lives? Their sociability, is it something that happens on a yearly basis or maybe, you know, over a longer period? And just how long do they live, out of interest?
Well, what we study in our lab is actually understanding when there is this onset of sociability in fish. And actually, Zebrafish, they are not social when they start on, but they become very social from 3 weeks onwards. And from that moment, they continue to be social. So it's very rare to find fish or zebrafish that are not swimming together or they're not shoaling together throughout their whole life. In terms of how long they live, it's basically around 2 years of age.
Will we become loners, I suppose, is what this started off asking. Will we become loners at the end of this, Eleanor? What do you think?
Well, I have a big hope that we're not, and I'm a very social person myself. So I think the answer is no. And we should, personally, I think we should also thank technology, because for how much we don't like technology, and you know, it's much better to see someone in person. Mm-hmm. It has been really helping a lot, our interaction with people, and I think we can definitely use it to connect with you know, relatives or parents that are far away right now. And so I think we should definitely use these media right now to keep us connected with other people. What we should definitely do is try to continue to maintain the relationships that we have before. So if definitely we let them go, so if we don't try to make any effort to keep them, yes, we lose, as I was saying before, the practice. So we could, in theory, become antisocial and become less socially engaged with other people. But if we continue, if we put a bit of effort, we are definitely going to continue. And because we're such social creatures, I personally don't think there is any way that we could definitely become non-social creatures. So I have big hope.
Well, it's very interesting. Elena, thank you very much indeed for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me. It has been a pleasure.
Now, you may remember a couple of weeks ago, Richard spoke to a pigeon fancier in Northern Ireland whose homing pigeon went missing for over 10 years after it set out on a race from Penzance. It was supposed to end up Northern Ireland. It didn't. It found its way to Spain somehow and has been there ever since and is doing quite well. Thank you very much. Now, we know that pigeons use some form of inbuilt navigation to find their way around. But is there more to it than that? Well, it appears there may well be. According to Science Daily, odours are known to be essential for navigation during homeward orientation and migration of some bird species. Yet, little was known about their chemical composition. Until now, an international team has identified volatile organic compounds that can be used for olfactory navigation by homing pigeons and prove the existence of suitable regional chemical gradients in the air on a landscape scale in Tuscany. To tell us more about this very interesting project from Germany, we're joined by Jonathan Williams, the project leader at the MPIC's Atmospheric Chemistry Department in Mainz. Jonathan, hello, how are you?
Well, hello, Derek. And yeah, to paint a little picture of what we normally do here, we take a very sensitive instruments out into the field and we measure very accurately the composition of the air in various places around the world. We take the instruments on aircraft, on research ships, sometimes deep into the Amazon jungle, but sometimes we take on other interesting problems, and the one that I think we're going to talk about today is about birds and how birds use their sense of smell to navigate.
And how do they do that exactly?
Well, that's something that we're trying to slowly but surely unpick. I think the background of the study comes from Italy, where I think almost 50 years ago, they first discovered that homing pigeons use their sense of smell to navigate home. And the way they did that, this is work not from my group, but from the University of Pisa in Tuscany, Italy, under the supervision of Professor Papi. What they did was they kind of discovered more or less by accident that pigeons need that sense of smell. In fact, what they need to do is while they're growing up at a certain place, they need to construct an olfactory map of the region. So you can kind of imagine it occurring like if you're growing up in a certain place and you know that when the wind blows from the north, you smell maybe the sea and the algae, or when you blow from another direction, maybe you smell the city or some factories or something like that. And over a three-month period, it seems that birds can construct in their minds an olfactory map of the region. And it's that olfactory map that they turn to when they're displaced somewhere else and are confronted with the problem of getting home.
I think anybody listening to this programme who lives in the Liberties in Dublin will be familiar with what you're talking about, because that's where they make the Guinness.
So the pigeons must be pretty good around there.
So that smell is well ingrained deeply in them. So you're talking about something like the way salmon behave, that they're able to come back and almost taste and smell the habitat from which they were spawned.
It's an interesting analogue, but that's, of course, the salmon do it in the water. And so these signals are quite different, because we're measuring them in the gas phase, in the air.
That's really interesting to hear that the results of that research. I know that pigeons seem to be absolutely remarkable birds when it comes to migratory ability, because I already knew that they seem to be able to sense or perhaps even see somehow the Earth's magnetic field. I know there's been work done in Russia and elsewhere on their ability to sense the Earth's magnetic field as well, and also gravity and gravity depressions that have been done there. So that's very fascinating. But the idea that they're also using these olfactory senses, it's yet another part of their arsenal, I suppose. It's quite remarkable. And the funny thing is that in a lot of pigeon species, particularly the feral pigeon, which is also the racing pigeon, generally their wild ancestors are non-migratory. So I wonder where this behaviour first came from, or where this ability came from, because it seems strange that it would evolve in a bird that is now basically non-migratory.
That's a very interesting question. Actually, going back to the magnetic perspective, that's indeed, I think, commonly known, and certainly birds can use that sense of magnetism to determine north, south, east, west, as you can do, of course, with the sun. But, of course, it doesn't help you find your way home. If I bundled you into a van with a blindfold and put you out somewhere and told you that way's north, it doesn't really help you get home. You kind of need a map. And that's the crucial element which the olfactory signals could bring you. And we've actually done some more recent work, actually, where we've actually proven that the birds do follow odor plumes to forage for food as well. We've proven actually that storks can actually follow the smell of fresh cut grass to look for snails and frogs and things like that, which they normally eat.
We know that with other bird species, the corncrake being a good example, they use a map, as you said, but instead of a smell map, as far as we can tell, it's a map of the night sky, of the stars, and they'll always try to navigate using those. And birds like that, obviously, on cloudy nights, they're not able to navigate anywhere near as effectively. So it'd be very interesting to know if this olfactory capability exists in other bird species as well. Do you know if it extends beyond pigeons and maybe storks and birds like that? Has any research been done in other species?
Yeah, I know of some research that's been done on seabirds whereby they've shown that they can detect a certain chemical, DMS, dimethyl sulfide. It's called a pungent molecule produced by phytoplankton in the sea, and it comes out of the sea. So if you're a seabird looking for somewhere to find a fish, it's good to smell that compound, because where phytoplankton are blooming is where fish are located. And that's been kind of shown. So there is some basis from seabird research that certain chemicals can be used as navigational aids, let's say, or navigational cues. But I'd not heard of this star map. I thought birds didn't fly so much at night. So I'm really surprised by that. It's really interesting. Yeah.
Quite a few birds migrate at night. A lot of songbirds, particularly members of the thrush family, they're almost exclusively night migrants. So at the moment in October, usually after around midnight, I'm hearing a little sort of squeak or cheep in the sky, which is redwings migrating to Ireland from Iceland. And they only do that at night.
Wow.
We're not quite sure how they actually navigate. It may be by stars, but I know that work has been done on corncrakes, which is a member of the rail family related to moorhens and coots that listeners might be more familiar with. And it seems that they do need to be exposed to the night sky as chicks, or they won't migrate correctly. It's also interesting that you mentioned DMS there. I was on a seabird watching trip a few years ago off County Kerry, and one of the people on the boat had a bottle of this DMS, which I believe is sometimes used as a food additive. He just opened the bottle, and within seconds, birds, especially European storm petrels, appeared out of nowhere. They were nowhere to be seen, and they're brought in very much by the smell. Very strong smell, I must say. It was very, very unpleasant for people on the boat. People actually got sick. It was very strong.
When we opened that one in the lab, we tend to give it a wide berth. It's quite a pungent smell, isn't it? Yeah. Oh, that's actually fascinating. I think that's how they discovered it, too. They put a dab of the DMS on some cotton wool and sort of waved it at the back of a ship and noticed how the seagulls sort of flocked from all parts. But that seems to be an attractant for them. And it makes sense, of course, because the biologically productive regions of the ocean are where you're going to see the most fish and the most potential to get food. So I think that's also a thing. But interesting, these long-distance migration routes that you were talking about. Now, I'm not sure if the birds are able to use chemical cues over such long distances, because the the chemicals themselves, they only last in the atmosphere for a certain amount of time. So oxidation occurs and they're sort of degraded slowly. So there'll be certain chemicals will give gradients or information, directional information, but only over restricted distances. So these really massive migration routes, I'm not sure what they could be using there. It might have to be something pretty long-lived in the atmosphere if they do use the olfactory cues at all. And there is this interesting project. I don't know if you've heard of the Icarus project from the Max Planck Institute for Ornithology. They've actually got a very interesting setup now working. I think there's videos of it on YouTube. But they can put very small chips in all sorts of migrating animals and monitor their behavior from the International Space Station. And it's a remarkable project. It's just got off the ground this year. So that might bring you guys a lot of new information about migratory habits of birds and animals and all sorts of things.
It's only relatively recently that we've had technology other than marked rings on birds' legs to monitor this migration. And of course, that has an advantage of being quite cheap and easy to do. But obviously, the return rate from these, or the recovery rate, is extremely low. And it doesn't tell us too much about the bird's intermediate journey. We know where they started or where they ended up, but we don't necessarily know how they got there or how they managed to achieve such a thing. So I think sometimes we've taken birds for granted. I know that very often it's been said that birds have no sense of smell or very poor sense of smell. So I think that perhaps some research has tended to ignore that aspect of their lives. And from what you're saying, it certainly seems that some birds that we thought to have no sense of smell actually do. It's a very vital function for their lives and for their survival.
Yeah, for me, it was kind of new also that birds were using their sense of smell to navigate. And I think for quite a lot of the ornithological community, it was also quite new. So this research that I'm engaged in here happened by a chance conversation with the director for ornithology from the Max Planck Institute for Ornithology. We just had a chance conversation, and he was remarking on some observations of these storks, and I said, well, it's highly likely that it's from the smell of the cut grass. And for him, it was kind of a shock, and that's what motivated us to start on this kind of research, to just do some simple tests by mimicking the smell of the grass and seeing how the storks behave. But how they relate in sensitivity to other animals, I really don't know.
One thing that occurs to me there was in the last couple of months in Western North America, with the terrible forest fires that have happened there, there were a large number of migratory birds, particularly warblers and also some members of the swallow family, that were found dead on the ground. It seemed that many of them actually suffered from exhaustion. They'd had difficulty navigating. It's assumed because of the plumes of smoke. And it was thought that this may have been visually interrupting their ability to see the landmarks that would normally follow. I'm now wondering if perhaps there was an olfactory component to that too, perhaps their sense of smell was overwhelmed by the smoke particles, or this obscured the olfactory map that they would normally use. That's something that only just occurred to me. I think maybe it merits more research.
That could well be. That's a very good explanation. I mean, it could be both, in fact. Of course, smoke plumes would, of course, reduce the visibility. Long-distance visibility is rapidly reduced to a few hundred meters or much less than normal. But, of course, biomass burning, that actually releases a gigantic cocktail of compounds out into the atmosphere. I mean, we know that from our research in Brazil, too, where we see a huge, complicated mixture emerging from any fires. And that would, of course, be different to the pattern of gradients that the birds would have learned. So I could well imagine that could have skewed them off course. And there's a few other examples where I've been thinking also along the same lines, where there was apparently a big loss of homing pigeons in England where they were going across the channel. And I was wondering whether that may have just coincided with a big phytoplankton bloom, where you could have got enormous emissions from the sea, which would have been abnormal and therefore contrary to what the map was saying in the head of the bird. And finally, and one comment I have to make is something that's amazed me from this whole research is that we used several tons of high sensitivity scientific equipment to get these maps produced, or these patterns of chemical movement. And the pigeons are only 400 grams. These tiny little things can actually do the same as what we can do with the best available technical measurement devices. It's amazing what they can do.
Well, it's fascinating stuff, Jonathan. Thank you very much indeed.
Very welcome. Thanks very much.
That's pretty much all we have time for today. My thanks to our researcher, John Bell O'Reilly, our broadcast coordinator, Jarlath Holland, and our panel of Dr. Richard Collins and Niall Hatch. Until next week, goodbye.
Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.
Mooney Goes Wild was presented and produced by Derek Mooney.